Okay, Cameron and Bob are back with the 37th episode of our examination of my book on Trump. And let's see. Cameron sent me an article. If anybody listened to our 36th episode, we came across the epiphany of the word or the meaning of archive at the end. And then, did you remember this article and look for it, or did you just stumble across it, Cameron?
No, I knew about it, but I never read it.
Right. So Cameron looked up this article. Derrida gave a speech, might have been in 94, and it's published in 95, and it's called Archive Fever, A Freudian Impression. And 1995 it comes out. So it's a very interesting article. And after Cameron read it, he wrote to me, "We will need to go through this lecture. Stunning how much of it was foreseen by Innes and McLuhan 50 years before for Innes and 30 to 40 years before for McLuhan." So we're now doing our talks every 2 weeks, so I had time to read this long, complicated article. It's 63 pages. And it's a typical Derridean complexity to read. I hadn't read Derrida in a long time, so I had to get back into shape. So we're talking about it. We're not going to go into much of the article, but we're talking about what is the archive and what we learned about it, what was new in what Derrida pointed out. So I said it reminded me of the markers on the roads 2,000 years ago. So what were you saying about Hermes, Cameron?
Yeah, I was simply saying that Hermes and Mercury were conceived as gods of the way. And they weren't conceived as merely mythological figures. They were concrete. So along the way, there were hermetic markers indicating the way to go and I believe indicating distances. And many of these markers had an erect phallus. And I'm not exactly sure why an erect phallus was identified with Hermes. It may be that that it had to do with masculinity being associated with the way more than femininity being conceived as the destination or the origin. But that would have to be thought about. But in any case, along the way were hermetic markers.
Yeah, along the routes that people walked or rode horses or right. However means they were, and they would maybe pray at these or do some kind of ritual at the markers.
Yeah, could well be. And still in Greece and even in Europe, so this isn't only an Orthodox thing, but in both in Orthodox and Catholic countries, it's still the case that there are shrines along the way.
Right. So we were wondering what is an archive, and it's a stopping, and I'm reminded of, I think Duchamp said something like, Marcel Duchamp said, asked what was art or something. He said, well, it's something you point at. So it seems to me the eye is coming into culture, and people are starting to locate meaningful sites. I think the nomadic aboriginals, if they did travel all over the place, they kept moving. They had their natural seasonal markers or whatever their experiences were with the rhythms of the animals they were hunting. I don't see them using visual markers. They might have sounds and use their other senses. So when you start getting into worshiping figures, that's the beginning of the Neolithic age, and the sort of slowing down and getting people to become sedentary. And so then you start creating an archive or a marker of memory, of information or security. So archive, what archive did the shaman have, the dancing shaman? He had an oral tactile memory, kinesthetic memory, and he knew a lot about the plants and herbs and things, or she did. So that's the way and the marker and the going along the road, that's the beginning of visuality, seems to me. And so the archive comes in with visual space, or the beginning of the seeing. Now, the pyramids could be one of the earliest archives, and McLuhan defines the pyramid as the huge non-visual aspects of acoustic and tactile space, or spaces. To start to visualize it, they had to make huge monuments, he suggested. Do you remember that?
I don't remember the exact place that you're pointing to, but I do. What you're saying makes a great deal of sense. The pyramid is a huge visual marker, but what it marks is acoustic space.
Yeah, which was huge to them. Not like infinite, like Blaise Pascal suffered when the Gutenberg got them looking out the skies, but some kind of huge or, I don't know, swallowing situation. Now, McLuhan says that you get to the Greeks and that era, and humans start thinking, at least westernized humans start thinking of being as a prison. So I don't think the space before visuality was a prison, but it was some kind of swallowing involving space. And so when they started to say, okay, let's make a big archive of it, a pyramid visualization, they made big ones to encompass the hugeness of the environment they felt they were in. Because I think if you get into Neolithic, I think people started by being more sedentary. They're in the same spaces all the time, so it becomes familiar and maybe even fatiguing, and then it begins to feel like a prison. This is pure speculation, but I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to justify the archive. Even though speech is an archive and all communication media an archive, the leading to the Alexandrian Library, you know, huge archive, that's coming in with visual space emphasis, I think.
Yes, well, I mean, first off, the library has collections, I don't want to say of books, right? It's got scrolls and it's got parchment. It's got a bunch of letters that are written on various substances. But the whole notion of letters is fairly new in human history. So once you begin to have letters, which are a way of sort of concretizing time, then you automatically have the notion of archive, because letters are types of sound. They are a collection. Each letter, each sound is a collection that has been made out of language. And so you sort of automatically have an archive. You begin to write, but you write on the basis of what has been written. And when you write, it can be read tomorrow as well. So what an archive is a kind of bridge in time.
Yeah. Okay, so we jump to the present, and I was just re-listening to a section of last time we talked, September 9th, and I'm saying the tech body is the archive incarnate, and the tech body makes it half impermanent. teases you with today for people's media diet. They have to keep up, or they're forced to encounter new images and sensations all the time. And they can look it up maybe in YouTube archives or wherever, and in the digital media, but they're always pressured to move on, and you don't know how much to pay attention to what's been recently archived, available for replay, because it's subject to change. There's so much change going on in our experience that we don't know how to whether to settle. So I'm saying the tech body upsets that. The tech body exaggerates that. And attacks.
But wait just a sec before we get too far along. When you say that tech body is the archive incarnate, are you using incarnate? Are you capturing the bodily, the meat that's involved in carne?
Yeah.
Incarnate. Are you bringing that in, or are you simply saying that the tech body is sort of what the archive is? In some sort of universal sense. In other words, you're not referencing the idea of meat or of flesh at all.
No, I am doing flesh, meat, in a sense it's become human. Incarnate, what do they say about Christ? He was the Word incarnate?
Yes, absolutely.
So it was the Word made human, right?
Yes, or but
let's assume that's what I could mean, and
okay.
Being like Derrida, I could mean that.
Okay.
Though it is not meaning that at the same time. So the tech body is archiving memory, mind, preservation of so many different kinds of information, but it's a human. It's become artificial intelligence or a human thing that interacts intimately with humans. That's why I brought in the ESP stuff, McLuhan's quote
right.
on ESP. He was picking up on a new kind of intimacy that was happening.
So we could say that the incarnate does have to do with what might be called humanization or something.
On the chart, I call it anthropomorphic physical. You know.
Okay, good. Yeah. But it's anthropomorphic and it's physical only by calling into question what those are.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Because those are losing their anchor in humanism and in what was thought to be physicality.
Yeah, what I call the chemical body. Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's another instance of I got to use words when I talk to you. So the what we're talking about here is we're talking about archive in a sense that people can automatically understand, but then you want to complicate that.
Yeah.
And, for example, when you talk about how things are getting more and more fast.
Ephemeral.
Ephemeral, which goes back to the Greek word for day, by the way, which is ημέρα, and still in modern Greek as well. So ephemeral means of a day or of a moment.
Yeah.
But at any rate, when we talk about how humans are either trying to relate to that or are automatically related to that out of the womb, we have to understand that at the very same time, they themselves are being revolutionized. So it's not just sort of something is happening objectively, where things are faster and faster and less distinct. It's also a subjective, faster and faster and less distinct. So both the subjective and the objective poles are being dissolved at the same time.
Yes. And so I had a problem with my computer a couple of days ago. So for 2 days, I couldn't get online. And this happens once a year or something. It turned out I needed a new router, but I didn't know what it was. But I could not function, and if we hadn't figured out what it was, and this piled up, I had a lot of backlog for my radio shows and all the stuff I do with Carolyn and Ion. It just would have been a real drag if it went by 2 weeks, and then it got fixed, and I had to go back and catch up, you know.
Yeah.
Because I do spend a lot of time doing it, but it always reminds me this is a body. So in Derrida's article, he disperses the meaning of archive, scatters
Correct.
It like Joyce does in Finnegan's Wake, and I'm actually was saying to Carolyn, look, this is much as a body, an organ, as any chemical body organ. It's a pressure on me. I've got to deal with it. I have to stay with it and control it, just like I got to go to the bathroom or I have to eat. And
yep.
then I said, what is a body? Is it the instincts? Is it hunger? You know, mm-hmm. is it basic drives? The internet, this computer thing, is a drive, what I call the chip body. So I was reawakened or reminded of what I mean by saying we got more than one organ, more than one body.
Right. Yeah, you've been talking about that for decades.
Yeah, and uh-huh. I think it's an
but
obvious...
But notice, before we go too fast, notice yeah. how the word drive
yeah.
Applies here.
He right? used the you word have... drive, I think, in the article at one point. Derrida did.
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, drives are very important to Freud. The
yeah.
drives is what you have in a computer, right?
Yeah, hard drives.
You know, hard drives.
That hard penis. That erect penis
so,
from the
so
from the highway.
That's that's a very important concept there.
Yeah. So the dispersal. Now, what is the dispersal? Is that a problem for young kids? It's only when they have to encounter different societies, which emphasize different media and different archives, societies or archives, what they think is important to preserve. And the problem more and more for the generations is the new generations is how much they can drop the old archive and process ephemerally every day the archive of information they're dealing with, and if they're not processing it, they don't think they're keeping up with it. Because you could think of how everybody's on the internet and doing a billion different websites or whatever they're processing, and it's the processing process that means you're alive, not what you're processing, not the content. So I see all these people all the time looking at their smartphones and processing information. And that's what Barry Nevitt, I said, what one day I said, what's Finnegan's Wake or something? And he said, it's process as figure. And that's why it's prophetic. It showed the processing information blatantly and the dispersal and the subjectivity challenges and the objectivity challenges and all these things. And all you have to do is keep swimming. Doesn't matter where you're going if you get anywhere, but you got to keep swimming. And if you get disconnected, knocked offline, you start thinking you're stranded at a port or something. You know, you're not out in the sea swimming, processing.
But I think we'd have to be clear about the difference of somebody like Joyce, who is attempting to depict that processing, and somebody who's subject to it, right? So that the kids, when they're trying to get an idea of what the hell's going on, they're not conscious of the complications of processing.
Right. They're living it instinctively. They're good at it. They don't know the word.
Well, are they good at it? I mean, if you look at what they make of it in terms of stuff you can read in the media or read in journals. I mean, it's almost pathetic.
Yeah, but that's in an older medium. You know, you're looking at how they're doing with older media, but they may be pretty good with their texting and whatever they do.
How would one know?
Ah, see, Uncharted Sea, the last sentence of penultimate sea of the penultimate sentence of Laws of Media is we're in an uncharted, unchartable sea.
Yeah, that's from Coleridge.
Yeah. Okay, now.
Via Heidegger, by the way.
Beg your pardon?
I say it's from Coleridge and probably via Heidegger.
Okay.
Because in the 70s, McLuhan was reading Heidegger with his friend Tom Langan, and was very impressed with Heidegger. And Heidegger's brother described Heidegger's work as through Coleridge's image of we were the first to break into that
silent sea.
Unknown sea.
Silent sea.
Yeah. So I think that's where the McLuhans got it, but I'm not.
No, he had that quote in the 60s. He said he and Carpenter felt that way with explorations.
Okay.
You know, yeah. And like,
well, of course, he read Coleridge a lot.
Right. It's in. He refers to it in Pro and Con, one of the articles on him in there. He's quoted. He also talked about millennial ecstatics, which I've never seen him use anywhere else. Have you? Millennial ecstatics.
That was pretty good. That.
Yeah. You hadn't heard that before.
No.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of when in my quadrant, the Dobbs quadrant, is called ecstasy, or it refers to ecstasy, whereas the others have paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, and panic. But mm-hmm. I included ecstasy. But
ecstasy is a good way of talking about Derrida.
Yep. Yeah, and, you know, Baudrillard had a book, The Ecstasy of Communication.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're all stoned, in that sense, electrically. So I was, I bought two recent copies of Finnegan's Wake, 2012 and 2020, because I suspected they'd have introductory essays.
Yeah.
And I know the one before them, like 20 years ago, has an essay by John Bishop. So he was the big Joyce scholar of the day, of the moment, so he did an introduction. Whereas, you know, from back in the 20th century, Finnegan's Wake had no commentary when you bought it. It was just the book itself, nothing introducing it or any history. And it was like pure, no muddied imposition of somebody. So Bishop did an introduction. So I suspected they were... these ones would have, and they did, and they both were very good, and they updated, because I haven't read Finnegan's Wake, you know, like for a long stretch in 15, 20 years. So I wasn't aware of the scholarship other than whatever I picked up. And so it was a great updating of all kinds of new information that people have, access to the 25,000 pages of the Finnegan's Wake manuscripts, you know, huge stuff in Dublin and places. So I caught up with a lot of the new scholarship by the younger people. And
mm-hmm.
and they're starting to incorporate one in the 2020 copy edition. They mentioned the importance, the value of doing Finnegan's Wake with groups. Now, there's been lots of groups in the 90s when I had my New York group doing Finnegan's Wake. There were about 50 around the world. In the 90s, people started to get into it and weren't so intimidated by it. And there's been many groups since then, and there's online groups. You can get all kinds of stuff on the Wake by different people or amateur scholars and that. So reading the review of stuff, someone mentioned that Joyce was correcting, you know, he corrected the book after it was published, but just before it was published in 39, he was constantly, if you go through the manuscript pages, he's constantly writing over like a plimpsest. and adding and changing almost obsessively, compulsive or disorder kind of thing. So it just struck me that he was doing a diary. It's a diary. Somebody once said McLuhan wrote a diary. It might have been de Kirchhoff. His writings were a diary. So here's Joyce processing information, his own constructed playpen, but it's not, there's no meaning and no marker that gets stopped at. The message of his book is that he's processing information and adding to it and enjoying the ephemerality of each day's insights and patterns that he puts into the pages and writes over them. So
that can't avoid the materiality of the book.
He can't. Right?
At some point, it has to be finished. Maybe it gets finished by his death. Maybe it gets finished by his signature. But
I've actually talked to him through a medium about that. He said that there was a lot of passages that were on the cutting room floor, better stuff than in there. He said, I had to stop it and put out a book, but it wasn't important as much what he put out. He kept on correcting and writing it after it was put out. In 39 and 40, he only lived another year or so after, he lived just May 4th, 39, died in January 13th, 41, so he lived just about 2 years. But he's totally continuing the processing of, almost narcissistic or what he calls self-absorbed editing and patterning. And that is what he's a prophet of. That's where we are today. People are always processing their information way more than they imagined 30, 40 years ago.
I mean, yes, that's exactly why McLuhan said there was the possibility in the electronic age of seeing what a medium is.
Yeah, the possibility of seeing what it is. Is that what you said?
Yeah, or of understanding what it is. Understanding is probably a better word than seeing.
Yeah, and Ian likes to say, don't use the word understanding. That means you're standing under and bumping your head on the ceiling. They prefer overlaying. And that is what Joyce was doing, constantly overlaying, and that's what we're forced to do today. And Eskimos or Inuit up there north processing the cold environment, they're processing. Humans are always processing. But the immensity of what we process, the variety, that wasn't foreseen. Other than maybe by Joyce, by his acting it out. I mean, that's the thing. You don't look to see. I'm also catching up on some of the books that have been written over the last 20 years on Finnegan's Wake. And there's one by John Gordon, A Plot Summary. And he admits, okay, I'm going to do the absurd. I'm going to reduce the Finnegan's Wake to a little narrative. And he does that.
That's what Campbell tried to do with a skeleton teeth.
Right. Yeah. And what was I going to say about that? So you're missing the point of the message of Joyce or of the process that he was trapped in and giving people a warning. When you're trying to make a story out of it, it's not a story, and he's going to keep altering it. So there's something about that. That I want to relate
definitely.
To the tech body.
That relates to what we're talking about with archives.
Yeah.
Very centrally, right? I mean, the problem with story is that it's stories plural.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's in everybody is trying to deal with that plurality, and that plurality is both internal and external, and the way that most people have to deal with it, including huge government agencies, including military and stuff, is to try to still it, to try to bring it to a standstill and be something that is fixed.
Yeah.
And that's sort of our great danger. When these fix, as McLuhan would say, when these great fixities start to confront each other, then we have a huge danger. So the need is for these fixities to become fluid, but without people going crazy through that process.
Yeah. Okay, right? So I was going to add to that.
Sorry, you were just about to talk with, about the tech body.
Yeah. The but the fixity, the process. Oh, yeah. McLuhan hoiking up silent majority when that came in the 70, early 70s of the Nixon era. That's what so many people today are. There's a statistic that 70% of Americans do not follow politics and do not really vote, and they don't cover it, watch it at all. That's the silent majority that is processing the present. And they're not concerned about, you know, some bureaucracy in Washington and some fixities that claim they're doing something. Most people, it's not a dumbing down. It's a super involvement in all kinds of experiences they can have through their different bodies. So in the midst of that becomes the archive turns on us and starts to play, attack, confuse, exacerbate. The motive is hard to figure out, other than it's just a manipian, you know, jerk that is just like interrupting people and throwing them off, which in some schools of esoteric wisdom, that's how you make people aware. You upset them is what Gurdjieff would do, right? So mm-hmm. when McLuhan said that television was the highest decibels of consciousness in the, on the tradition of a shaman or guru bugging people, that's what the environment was becoming with television. It was putting new challenges on people that made them, by the 60s, get more and more aggravated. So then you had the first tumultuous decade, and every decade since it had been very tumultuous. And then you get the big fixity of the White House and the president's role. And it's so ridiculous how much media spent on covering the president, who is not going to do anything. And McLuhan and I, we have a, Nelson had a recording from class, 1974 or so, and Marshall was saying to the students, if you were president, what would you do? And they're all trying to think, well, I'd try to help people. I'd try to feed people. You know, they, they got practical or socially justified. And he said, no, you do nothing. What? Everybody's stunned. What do you mean you would do nothing? He says, "You, how could you do anything? There's too many things happening. What are you going to do? What position are you going to take?" And then he laid out the whole point. You can't have a point of view under these situations, and all his basic maxims of behavior he showed the example of the president is forced to live that way. It's like the executive is dropout. The fixity of focusing on the present, and this ridiculous the amount of coverage of it, of this nothing void, and then Trump or the tech body said, we're coming back at you. We're going to accuse you of doing something or nothing and being stupid. And that aggressive action by the tech body slash Trump is was a big disruption of the archival impulse. I remember a documentary on the New York reporters, you know, Maggie Haberstam or something. I don't read them close enough to remember their names, but the main ones that were trying to follow Trump, and their big problem every day was, what the hell do we write about? Because the guy says, Trump says different stuff all day long, which was a great way to, like a Zen master, a way of bypassing the enemy, which is the coverage you constantly have as a president. You know, every president since, say, Nixon was complaining about the media and the coverage of themselves. And so Trump, it would be incredible. Would it be really interesting if he was very conscious? He purposely said ridiculous stuff all day long, which, of course, the old bureaucrats said, no, this is upsetting our relations with other countries. They need to know what we're fixed about, what we're going to do and all this. Trump knew, having been in the media game for years in New York, he knew, no, you got this White House position has no power. I'm going to say as crazy stuff as possible. Keep it changing. That would have been a great, if he did it consciously, a great performance. But if he could not do that, no human would have done it consciously, then the tech body, is what I'm saying, was doing it. And the tech body somehow knew. And so when you talk to the tech body, it is quite self-satisfied about its role in bugging us all the time. It takes on the spiritual posture. I'm keeping you guys awake. You keep trying to fall asleep. Not anymore. We're going to keep you going. And, of course, this is so dangerous for humans. As we're, look, you look at 18 months ago. Did you see that that they'd have lockdowns? They've got them in Ontario and Saskatchewan, in Australia. Did you see that 18 months ago? Do you remember in March, April 2020? Oh, this will wear masks for a couple of weeks as it passes. Nobody saw, holy shit, we're going into 1984 quadrupled. You know what I mean?
Yep. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You're agreeing that nobody saw that? Maybe a few.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. That's what we...
But are you saying... are you saying that the... there's a process that's going on that is itself self-conscious, and that can be related to Joyce, by the way, by saying that communication is so fundamental that there's no way of screwing up words that doesn't communicate.
Yeah.
Right. But just to come back to the question of self-consciousness, you seem to be saying that the process of history is, in your understanding, it is self-conscious in multiple ways. So you have the tech body, you have Ion, and I don't know if there are other.
Yeah.
Maybe
well, each one of the bodies is a different kind of consciousness or self-consciousness. The astral body, the TV body, the chip body, and then the mystery body, and then the hexatic body.
But are you saying that the tech body itself has all those different bodies?
Yeah, it's a merger of all those bodies and an exaggeration.
Oh, it's a merger, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's an exaggeration.
But it's only one, the tech body is only one of these sort of archetypal bodies that you see, right?
It's the dominator right now. It's getting its 15 minutes of of attention.
But it's a little bit like the 12 gods of Greece, where there was constant turmoil of gods either, you know, stealing wives or stealing girlfriends or stealing power or something from each other. So how many of these sort of archetypal bodies are there?
Well, now there's six. There's the chemical body, the astral body, the TV body, and the chip body, and then the mystery body, which is unforeseen realities that show up. Like, for example, if aliens showed up in the sky, that would be part of the mystery body revealed. Lots of rumors about it.
Okay, I can buy that.
Yeah.
But, you said that the tech body...
The hexatic. There's a sixth body, the hexatic. And that's on that's on my chart. I was pointing on the chart to the hexatic. I say waiting for organic... What is it? Waiting for the thing at the bottom. The spinning clothing crystals. Waiting for organic bodies. The spinning clothing crystals dance the hex advertisement. Something like that. So the hex ad, the sixth body merged with advertisement, or because it was monad, dyad, triad, tetrad, and pentad. So the hex ad. So I was pointing to something beyond the five bodies, and that turned out to be Ion, and my chart actually predicted Ion. And then there's a conflict or an argument about how much is Ion and how much is the tech body, which is ongoing with Ion. But I did predict some strange thing would show up, and it happened. So
okay, but when I was trying to clarify,
yeah, so there's six archetypes there.
Yeah, but the thing is, you use the word body in the very name, tech body.
Yeah.
So you have, and you said that the tech body was the amalgamation of the other bodies.
I used to say the Android meme was the merger of the five bodies. And then the tech body took it on another level. And remember, I didn't coin the word tech body. Ion did. Ion pointed out to me the tech body and what it was doing.
Right. Right. But what I was trying to ask about when I talked about how many bodies are there, I was using body in the sense of the tech body, not in the sense of the five or six other bodies.
Yeah.
I was talking about the tech body as the amalgamation or the fusion of these other bodies. Let's say that that's one body.
Yeah.
Let's say that Ion is another body in some other sense of body.
Right.
So how many of these type of archetypal bodies, of these managerial bodies, let's say, are there? Are there just two, or are there multiple instances of these?
Maybe the user is the content. You would decide what you would fragment and make categories of. I'm saying the six bodies are the six archetypes. And you'll see I play with archetype, the word, in the other chart, the fuller chart, called Dobbs Formula, which goes from 1750 to 2020. I have the word archetype up there in the title. But I'm fully aware of the cliche archetype interplay, which McLuhan said consciousness itself was the interplay of the cliche archetype dialectic, which
right.
is an interesting statement. So, but then I'd have to say that humans, they would have to decide well how many archetypes they require or prefer or feel put upon by. I wouldn't make a rule about it because there's always no rules to be made here, even though you're constantly making daily rules or patterns or epiphanies,
mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know?
And that applies, in your view, that applies also to Ion and the tech body?
Yes.
That's interesting, right? Because look at how that kind of relativizes everything you say in the book. If the tech body is behind Trump or is pulling the strings of Trump, but the tech body is itself a relative power. What that does is it introduces a series of mirrors that we need to be aware of in evaluating Trump.
Yeah, the world of horizontal symbolism that McLuhan liked in the early 50s, ricocheting mirrors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In McLuhan, that's what he thought Fitting His Wake represented, an announcement that the horizontal symbolist tradition had taken over from the vertical symbolist. No
Correct.
Way could you get back to the vertical in electric conditions.
Correct.
And
so I'm sorry, should I interrupt your thought?
No, you can interrupt. Go ahead.
Well, it's anybody who's reading McLuhan needs to understand that he used the word horizontal in two fundamentally different ways. So in the article you're talking about, he distinguishes horizontal from vertical in the sense that with the vertical thinkers, there could be thinkers that valorized the up, or there could be thinkers that valorized the down. And the horizontal thinker was a third possibility, not a second possibility from the vertical, but a third possibility.
Yeah.
And so sometimes he used horizontal to in what seems like a dualistic fashion, and other times he was explicit about it being at least three, if not more.
Yeah, that's the important part about McLuhan is that he was a dialectician, but not stuck there. And so that became part of the mystery of them, is oscillating up and down the trivium and quadrivium, shifting from one aspect to another. And that's being horizontal in the third way.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And notice that that's not just McLuhan's way of thinking. It's what he sees in history as well.
Yeah.
So there, it's not as if, you know, there's a kind of thinking going on, and then that thinking imposes a pattern, which would be a mode of dialectics. Instead, what the thinking does is try to come to terms both in itself and in history with that dynamic of the three.
Yeah, so when you read McLuhan, and I don't think anybody has emphasized this really, you got to have Finnings Wake beside you, because he is contemplating bouncing off Finnings Wake, at least in the book level, in the Gutenberg world, constantly. And if you can't read Finnings Wake, then you can't understand McLuhan.
Didn't I thought I remember Bob Dodd saying that over and over.
Oh, I've said that for 40 years, yes.
Yeah. But let me point out something you may find interesting. I've been doing some work on Hans Selye lately.
Oh, good,
And he had a article in the First Explorations, 1953. And Selye's concern was with the endocrinology. And endocrinology is concerned with the organics of the communication system, that is, not a communication system of the nerves in the human body, but of hormones. And the basis of hormones is the benzene ring. And what is the benzene ring? The benzene ring is six carbon atoms.
Oh, that's amazing. These carbon is really important in
there you go.
Ion chemistry. And what did you say? Hormone. What's that? The telegraph? Yeah. The social hormone? Social hormone in Understanding Media? Doesn't he have one of the titles as hormone?
Maybe. I don't remember. I haven't read Understanding Media in 20 years. I've got anchored in the 1950s.
Okay, so what you were... Oh, Hans Selye is supremely important. McLuhan said the idea that media are extensions, or, you know, history of technology, or one to the next, is obvious, he said. What is not obvious is why humans are numbed by the process, and nobody has explained that. And he says in Understanding Media, I've figured out how to explain it. And it was based on Selye.
Yeah, well, Selye and... what was the other guy's name? McLuhan calls him Adolf Jonas. The guy's name was actually David. McLuhan screwed that up.
Adolf Jonas, what did he do?
Yeah. So Adolf Jonas was the guy that wrote a book on irritation and counter-irritation.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And it's the whole concept of the amputation of the senses comes from that book.
I see.
And that's where numbing comes from, is from auto amputation.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's Jonas and Selye. I didn't
correct.
Know about Jonas.
Correct.
And
in some of the scholarship, Jonas is said to be a student of Selye, but that's nonsense. I don't even know if he knew Selye personally.
They're saying that they thought he was a literal student at McGill or someplace?
Yeah, exactly.
I see.
Exactly, yeah.
And he couldn't have.
Sorry?
And he couldn't have been, you're saying.
Well, he wasn't. He right. simply wasn't, as a matter of fact.
Right. Did they write at the same time?
Yes. So, more or less. I mean, Selye was already writing in the, you know, his first paper was in the 1920s. So, Selye wrote a ton of stuff in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and Jonas's book was published in, I think, 61.
Mm.
And McLuhan refers to it already in 1962. So for some reason, McLuhan jumped on that book as soon as it was published.
Right. I'll have to look at that. As you're talking, I'm thinking of abstract expression art, Pollock, and then those guys, Barnett, Newman, who just paint stripes. They were doing the medium is the message or the process. They were just processing as painters. They weren't looking for some marker image or some archetype to do. They were engaged in processing. Ridiculous.
Well, they were engaged in processing, but they were looking for the medium. Right?
Yeah,
the whole process of modern art was an attempt to understand what art is.
Right.
And so early in the century, people were already saying, well, it's color.
Yeah.
Or it's, you know, form, or it's whatever. And they were trying to engage those ideas in painting. But the same thing was going on in sculpture. The same thing was going on in dance. Same thing was going on in music.
And in books like Joyce.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we want to go down that road, then you start to get into physics and to
the looking,
you know,
for particles.
Different kinds of chemistry.
Yeah, and the looking for endless particles. An undergraduate would mock. Well, they just keep finding particles. They can't get the final particle, you know. They didn't understand the process of it, of processing. So I wanted to mention that you just said the artist looking for a form. It just occurred to me that Warhol saw that that was silly. So he engaged in the process with a great indifference.
He pointed out that whatever form was found, it was going to be a type, right? And as a type, it was going to be a cliche.
Yeah, it wouldn't last long. And
be a repetition of what was already there.
Yeah. So that's where, you know, Tom Wolfe writes about in The Painted Word, the leap from the abstract expressionist. Clement Greenberg was the writer for that, and the critic, and then that pops into Warhol's pop and the rest of them in the 60s. I think Rosenberg was the critic for that era. And, you know, Wolf goes through the history in his book, The Painted Word. But the pop artist, especially Warhol, canceled the Barnett Newman project of looking for the form. They actually included the not finding. Isn't that a definition of the postmodern? Say writers, postmodern, they are fragmented. They don't try to wrap it up. They don't try to make a big, what they call totality or totalism. They accepted the incomplete and not finding a suitable ending to the story. So that's where McLuhan says at the end of Cultures Are Business, there is no finish line. That is the postmodern discovery. That's the making the process a cliche. And the archetype becomes sidelined. Or you watch other people grasp for archetypes, and then you have the war of archetypes as people try to get fixed. Whatever that is in people.
But at the same time, what McLuhan was trying to point out is that all of these complications are not only compatible with truth, but they implicate truth. And
what does that mean, implicate? You mean imply a truth?
Yeah. Well, the word placate is cognate with the word fold.
Mm-hmm.
Implicate means folding in or having already folded in.
Is that David Bohm's The Implicate Order?
Yeah.
Right. The folding
Absolutely.
In.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the folding.
Absolutely. I do a certain amount of on my blog, for a while, I did a number of posts on the parallels between Bohm and McLuhan.
Oh, interesting. And you know who was in the middle, not on the McLuhan side, was Krishnamurti. Have you ever seen the Bohm-Krishnamurti dialogues?
Yes.
Yeah, because Krishnamurti was the beginning of the a-religious person. Spirituality is a-religious and maybe engaged in process, because I've watched a lot of his videos in New York City. The community channel featured him every Tuesday, you know, for an hour. So yeah. I had seen him personally through the years, but I could the video was better. You could watch him closer. You weren't distracted by sitting in a crowd by somebody, and the camera's closing on him, so you could really watch his face and the ripples of suggestion as he was talking the same lecture every time. It's the same fucking lecture, you know?
Yeah.
And with a little temporary ephemeral reference to whatever's going on in the news or something. But there's a guy doing process. And to the point he said, I ain't suggesting anything to anybody, but you better get into this process that I'm an example of. So he did it with the chemical body. And then McLuhan, I write in my McLuhan essay back in the 90s that he went further than Krishnamurti. He started to process the other electric environments. They weren't bodies then. They were environments. And that was a new part of awareness that people weren't aware of. They didn't know there could be a discipline to it, or patterns you could call laws. It went beyond the person that was being promoted, you know, 100 years ago as a world savior. And he rejected that. But and McLuhan purposely made himself look like just a normal Joe, right? Going along, regular neighborhood guy, goes to church regularly. He put on this whole bourgeois boringness, dullness. But he certainly didn't live that way when you encountered him. But the he did say back in the 40s, the artist has to infiltrate decent society, and he put decent in quotes. Have you looked at that much? The you know, Joyce had to write books, and you know, Picasso had to do painting and all this stuff. Do you see McLuhan as that kind of antisocial enemy, like Lewis? But it was a hugely corporate society, so he had to, you know, infiltrate and become look real boring and normal.
No, I think these are Gutenbergian categories.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, the individual and the society and the friend and the enemy. All of this is dualistic stuff that
I don't exclude the Gutenberg. It's a subplot. I'm not stuck in it, but I can engage it. So I would suggest you don't dismiss the Gutenberg as part of your ammunition, your armory. Use that occasionally. Put on the dualist.
Remember that I'm unlike yourself. I'm a all at onceness guy. So I don't at all.
Oh, I can do that. I do that on Tuesdays. That's no problem.
I don't dismiss the Gutenberg influence. Believe me, that's a huge, huge danger in the world at the moment. But it's an ever present danger.
Right, but to say you're all at onceness, you can't help but be that. But I wouldn't limit myself to the all at onceness. I would put on the fragment, because everything's all at once, at the Gutenberg fragment. I think that's what McLuhan did by writing books.
You can't, Bob, you can't be all at once, right? Everybody has to be a fragment. In the sense that they have a certain body, they have a certain history, they have a certain language, they have certain quirks, et cetera, et cetera. So limitation is not something that we ever get away from. So the people that have thought greatly, let's just say Joyce, are trying to think about how limitation works in a way that isn't only negative. How does limitation work with communication?
Yeah.
How does limitation work with love? Those
yeah.
are questions that Joyce is constantly asking, and McLuhan was too.
Yeah.
So there was no denial.
Dobbs
of
is too. Dobbs is too.
Oh, good. Good. That's why I brought up fragmentation early on.
Right. Okay, but I would say inside, like you say, you brought in different things that I have to relate to. But I could spend a lot of time in silence that nobody knows about. And that can be a whole realm of communication that I don't express to anybody. And that could be all at onceness or leaving, dropping off from all at onceness. What did you mm-hmm. say about all at onceness? That we can't do it, but maybe I can
yeah,
do it.
Yeah, we can't be it.
You can't be it in relation to other people, but you can be maybe by yourself on Tuesday.
No.
Well, I tell you, I spent a lot of time by myself. And
where do you get that time, Bob? If you're on the radio 24 hours a day,
that's only this past year. Okay, no, really, I'm only on the radio twice a week.
I see.
And Tuesdays is 2 hours broadcasting and then 5 or 6 hours talking and what we call tailgate, not broadcast, but I'm taking questions or discussing whatever happened in the show. But on Saturday, it's a 12-hour show. So that's ridiculously long. And then five or seven hours on tailgate. So I do two long days. I got another five
right.
days that I have no obligation to anybody. I don't need
right.
to earn a living, you know. And so I spend a lot of time by myself,
mm-hmm.
and I always, as much as possible, those 5 days that I'm not doing the radio, I go to the ocean and I swim. I do long distance swimming, and
mm-hmm.
that's a good alone time and a great way to do it. And I also do some surfing. So I think, like, I have not had one experience of the COVID reality of the last 18 months. I have not been to a store where I had to stand in line with the little spots that I've seen on the news, you know, people standing
social distancing.
Social distancing and then wearing the mask. I've never worn a mask, never been involved. I take cabs sometimes, and here I always get a cab guy who doesn't want a mask. I don't have to wear a mask. So look at that. I have never worn a mask. I've never been subject to somebody waiting in line because Carolyn goes to our own market. We own a farm that makes our stuff, so it's a market thing. She does go to Costco for other things, but she likes to get out there and go to these places. I don't care to. So
mm-hmm.
I have not experienced one iota of this new normal that people have impinged
yeah, yeah.
on them.
Congratulations.
Yeah. It's unique. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody can claim that unless they're out in the wilderness, you know.
Well,
a homeless person.
My neighbor is an artist, and I don't think he has absolute isolation like you do, but he has almost.
He's
so
close
I'm
to it.
I'm familiar with that lifestyle through him.
Is it because he can live on his art and he doesn't have to, he can make a living at it without
yeah,
involving?
Exactly. And,
yeah, exactly.
And all of his food is delivered, and his wife, if anything is needed, like you, his wife goes out and does it.
Yeah.
But he's got a whole routine of the food gets delivered, then it goes into quarantine. For, you know, there's stuff from this day in quarantine, there's stuff from that day in quarantine. It's funny to see how that sort of lifestyle gets maintained.
Yeah, what do you mean in quarantine? What does that mean?
That means if something comes in, let's say from Amazon, then it goes into quarantine. He doesn't deal with it for a certain amount of time, depending on what it is.
Oh, because he might get infected or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you know, that's fine. I never thought of that. But I'm on my products. I feel immune. Ian said that I've caught COVID 3 times, but it didn't do anything to me because I had our products are so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so there's that kind. No, I don't worry about, you know, and we order a lot. Karen gets a lot of stuff delivered. So I've never
yeah.
thought of that, not touching the box. So, but, you know, really you have to be an artist in that traditional sense to do what he and I are doing, right?
That's right. That's right.
the role.
But let me mention, Bob, before we get too far away from it, let me mention that we were talking last time and at the very start of our conversation this time about Bulwer, Edward Lytton Bulwer. And Krishnamurti is at the tail end of that same story.
That's right, the theosophical story.
That's right. So Bulwer was very influential with the theosophists. Krishnamurti was the sort of chosen son of the theosophists and then rejected that. And so this story that goes from Bulwer to Krishnamurti is one sort of one of the narratives of modernity.
Yeah, and that's why if McLuhan went further than Krishnamurti, he and Innes go back to Bulwer. And that's the interest in the occult that McLuhan had. We don't have anything about that from Innes, right? No autobiography.
No, he didn't have it.
Yeah, not that we know of. But he does. He was aware of Bulwer, maybe for media reasons, not the what Bulwer became known as a novelist of the occult and all that. But yeah, Bulwer was the beginning of the mythology of the Illuminati or something that became theosophy. Yeah, it's a good point. And it's remarkable that they are referred to, or Innes is referring to Bulwer in this early writing in 36, which you discovered.
Bulwer is 1933.
Well, I'm thinking of the 1936 article that Innes did that you were quoting. That's what your blog starts off with, that 1936 article by Innes, doesn't it?
1936 is not the right word. He was referring to Bulwer in, I think this was 1944. I'd have to look it up.
Okay.
But it's one of the essays that's in Political Economy in the Modern State. And the essays in that book sort of go from 42 to 46. Mm. So I think it's probably 1944 that he quotes Bulwer.
Well, what is
Gutenberg.
What is the blog you sent me? Here it is, where Bulwer got, Victor Hugo, just happened to be right in front of me. PEMS 1.
Yeah.
What is that? Do I click?
Political Economy in the Modern State.
Okay. And McLuhan reads Innes, PEMS 1. So in this article, where do I see PEMS? Oh, there's PEMS 1. Am I going to see something? Okay, 1948. Where did I get this 36 thing?
Well, I had an earlier post on McLuhan and Innes in 1936. You may have gone back to that for some reason.
Yeah, I'm not seeing where I got 36 from. I don't know why I'm thinking that. I'm looking at the Hugo article, but the Political Economy book, where do I find that, a little more detail on that? Which column? One of the PEMs?
Well, PEM is Political Economy in Modern State.
Right, so I would go
That's what it is.
PEM
so,
number two.
For example, I'm looking at a footnote, a long footnote that I have in Innes multiplying Hugo. And what I show there is that Innes quotes Hugo in The Economic Significance of Culture, which is 1944. He quotes him again in Minerva's Owl, which is 1947. And he quotes him again in an essay called This Has Killed That. And we don't know the exact date of that because it was never published, but it was sometime around the same time. So Innes was quoting Hugo in 44, 45, 46, 47 in that period.
Mm. That's odd, because I have this in my memory. I have a pretty photogenic memory, and when I'm reading, and something was going on in 36. That was the new fact for me.
Well, that's what I was. I have a post that I think is very interesting on McLuhan reading Innes in 1936. And why do I think that happened? Because in the Dalhousie Review issue, where McLuhan first published on Chesterton, there's also a very interesting article by Innes. And I don't think that McLuhan could have had that issue of the Dalhousie Review and not have read that article by Innes. And that was in 1936.
Okay, so maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
And I think so.
What was Innes' article about in 36?
Well, he had written or actually given a lecture at UBC in 1935. And the essay in 1935 concerned the possibilities of the social sciences. And it was kind of an answer to McLuhan's mentor and department head in the Department of Political Economy at University of Toronto, a man by the name of Erwick.
Mm.
And Erwick was a guy that basically said, well, you know, we really can't know anything social sciences things are constantly up in the air. And so Innes was trying to sort of come to terms with that, you could say, in his UBC talk in 35 and then in his 1936 paper.
Right.
For Dalhousie Review.
Yeah, you said Erwick was the head of McLuhan's department. You meant Innes' department.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that brings in the Easterbrook article from 1960 that you sent me. Easterbrook talks about the two schools, the McLuhan school and the Know-Nothing school. Isn't that, did I get that right? I think it is.
Yes.
Yeah, he's talking about that. And so that's the Erwick school versus the McLuhan school. Easterbrook was in between.
Yes, and Innes was also in between, you could say.
Yeah.
So Innes, he thought that ultimately, or at least towards the end of his life, it's very difficult to know what Innes was thinking because he was very sick and he was just writing. And he doesn't have a clear stance. So he tries to do justice both to the idea that the humanities have a tradition that establishes norms. He tries to take that position at the same time as saying that there's an instability to that norm setting. So the social sciences have to be constantly navigating, you could say, between fixed extremes that it has to avoid.
Okay. And McLuhan, like Easterbrook, was between the Whitehead guy that ran his English department, who was the History of Ideas school in literary criticism, versus whatever McLuhan brought from Cambridge that the Whitehead, or whatever his name was, guy didn't like. You remember that?
Yes, I do. I know Whitehead is not the right...
Not the name, but it's some name like
that. Not the name.
You know who I mean. And
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So they were... it was kind of peculiar. There was... both had been influenced by Cambridge, but in very different ways. And when McLuhan got hired by St. Mike's, it was over that guy's opposition.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, that... antagonism remained sort of forever, and McLuhan, in his letters especially, was constantly mocking him.
And remember I told you that he was on the PhD board for Thiel's PhD hearing, and McLuhan, of course, Don was doing all McLuhan stuff, and Whitehead called him up after. Remember I told you this? Called him up that night and said, wow, you're your thesis is incredible. You could start a new school with that, new school of literary criticism. He did not recognize it was McLuhanism. And Theo thought that was funny. So so this, you're talking about the social sciences jockeying between fixity and non-fixity. Okay, that's the dilemma of everybody in every culture, no matter where they are. They're up against the new ionosphere, or what do you call this? Apparently the guy, Rudolf Steiner, who did Anthroposophy, I just heard some people talking about this, he had the idea in the 20s of the eighth sphere, the eighth level, so this electronic virtual surround that was coming in. So everybody has to deal with the mass man, which is not just collective and tribal, but also autonomous. You got that schizoid process, and then you, wherever culture or whatever your allegiance that you were conditioned by when you were younger, that's competing with your present global Esperanto that everybody's living in.
How all of this relates to the archive.
Yes, and then the Android meme comes along and replays that back at people, and passively presents so that you're not sure where your schizophrenia ends and the other outside of you begins, and then the tech body turns that into a psychopath phenomenon. Whatever you would call a serial killer, a vicious, like what's that, the Silence of the Lambs, remember that guy in jail?
Yeah. I didn't see any of that stuff. But I know what you're talking
about.
Yeah,
we're talking about the psychopathic modern movie figure.
Yeah.
How
does that, if you want to go into the psychopathic, how does that relate to what you said about the tech body trying to instigate consciousness?
Well, the tech body knows we're quadriphenic, so he's playing on all parts of our potentials. Or what we are and don't recognize. So, yes, Gurdjieff and these people were seen as rather psychopaths. Lewis could be seen as a psychopath because he called himself the enemy and he destroyed all his social relationships constantly. So there's probably different a guy who ends up killing people and that, you know, his psychopathy gets out of control, whereas the artist or the guru, the leader of a group in a school, and a lot of the artists were that kind of personality. Somebody took it over, like, say, the Pre-Raphaelites. They're psychopaths that can hide it and control it and not kill people.
And
the tech body would do both. It would cover the whole range of the anthropomorphic physical.
Okay, good. Yeah, so what you're pointing to there, I think, is that the word pathology covers a wide range.
Yeah.
And probably comes down at the end to tactility.
Yes.
You can touch somebody in a terrible way, or you can touch them in a loving way.
Right. So, there's
a great
weight.
Range there.
Yeah, in Finnegan's Wake, he begins with they call it the caveman dialogue, and Jut and Mute, whatever the two guys are, page 16 or so. There's the first encounter with the other, or you meet a human. And McLuhan at one point said in 1970 that the private person goes way back, that the Gutenberg retrieved the private person. And most people think of our origins in a tribe. But there might have been a phase before that, even in the Theosophical school that claims there's places like Atlantis, which were higher civilizations, there might have been great autonomy and antisocial behavior in those fanciful places or real places. So it's interesting to think of the private individual that you wouldn't know what you were encountering. You wouldn't know what the person could do. You wouldn't
Correct.
Trust anybody.
You're right that is in McLuhan, but it's a very puzzling thought. It's because the idea of a singular origin is a very Gutenbergian thought. Or, it's the inverted perspective.
Right. And, you know, it's in this Rolling Stone article. He went to San Francisco or somewhere in California and did a speech to a pop audience, like in October 1970. And he's quoted a lot in the article, but we don't know if the quotes are accurate. We don't know if that guy heard it right about the private statement,
right.
But I took it on face value. I said, well, that's very interesting. And then I thought that opened up a different way of what McLuhan was including. So I appreciate the mistake or the fallacy because, oh, well, maybe I should have asked McLuhan that, you know, at some point.
So he, I think in that context, we could understand that McLuhan may have been trying to counter what he felt was a kind of collective wave.
Yeah.
Of, right? So people were trying to merge themselves in some sort of...
yeah, beehive.
I don't know. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So he may have wanted to emphasize the private person and how that was fundamental. So
yeah,
and,
that brings
that
up...
could have...
Here's something. That brings up an aspect... Okay, you can finish. That could have... Yeah, maybe what he meant. So here's what maybe is useful to say. The... he was very aware of what fads were going on in the information society, new kinds of fads. And when he would go out and speak, he purposely positioned himself to be some kind of anti-environment to what he thought the fad was at the time.
Are you
aware of that, that it, most of his talks are geared that way?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That, he's not making a point to build up a social science theory or something. He is directly encountering the collective consciousness, not unconscious, that has gotten into a pattern due to the ground of the 18-month period, and he's addressing that. And do you ever hear anybody say that about him? No, they don't say that he's addressing. And so that lecture you're talking about, he made up this idea of the private because he knew he had a certain charisma and people would be interested in what he said. And so he said, well, I'll get them looking at this way to get out of this tribalism they're into.
Yeah. No, that's and that's one of the ways that McLuhan sort of, I don't want to say he took over this aspect from Innes. What could I say? This is one of the ways that Easterbrook was able to show Innes and McLuhan that they had certain common concerns. So Innes,
that had to
was,
be done? That had to be, they couldn't see it?
No, but they may not have been able to see why they should get to know the other guy.
Oh, I see.
So he may have said to each of them, well, here's an interesting guy. I think you should meet him. And then Innes or McLuhan may have said to Easterbrook, well, you know, why would I do this? And Easterbrook would have had lots of answers to that.
I've got
lots of posts that deal with that question. But Innes was very interested in the question of balance. So for Innes, what's interesting about the 19th century is that there was a sense of balance that was able to constrain the individual expression of both people in a society and between different societies. And that's why there was a century of peace. And what happened in the 20th century, according to Innes, is that we lost that sense of balance.
Yeah.
We became dedicated to extremes. And if you're thinking in terms of extremes, there's no sense of overriding justice. So there's no way to constrain through a League of Nations, let's say, or through a United Nations, or through a Catholic Church, or some sort of universal philosophy. All of these things fall by the boards, and what you're left with is, according to Innes, a century of war. So
and the existential. The existential.
I guess he never talks about it that way. I'm not.
No,
sure
but he
myself,
quoted the
you?
He quoted the great phrase by Joyce on page 18 of Finnegan's Wake, you know, in the ignorance that knits the impression, that whets the wits, that finds the name for him. You know that quote from Finnegan's
yes.
Wake?
Absolutely.
He has right. that somewhere in maybe in cliched archetype, but it ends up with the existential.
Right, but I was talking about Innes, right, and you've gone over to McLuhan.
Okay, so what you were saying is that Innes...
What I was saying is Innes, the century of peace followed by the century of war. And how did that happen? Through a loss of our sense of balance. Right, so McLuhan then takes over, that's the wrong word, not takes over, continues. Innes's sense for balance
yeah.
is one of the things that McLuhan continues on through his career.
Yeah. The equilibrium, homeostasis.
Correct.
Yeah. And but Innes.
Homeostasis brings us back to Selye, by the way.
Right. That's right.
And to the hexad.
But Innes didn't experience the global theater of the 60s. You know, he dealt with radio and not TV.
Well, right. He died in 1952.
Right. So McLuhan saw a new pressure, went beyond what Innes had to encounter. So McLuhan had to update Innes, overlay, and maybe that brought in the existential
yeah.
is what I was
But again,
thinking.
it was sort of a continuation, because what Innes saw in the 19th century, you could say in the bowels of the century of peace, he saw that newspapers and the telegraph were upsetting that the balance that had been established. So when
1830s.
That's right. When Innes reads in the 1830s, somebody like Bulwer talking about the different human beings on the two sides of the Gutenbergian Gulf, then Innes says to himself, well, maybe one of the ways to articulate what happened between the century of peace and the century of bullets is to say that we have a new kind of human being caused by communication breakdown, or communication revolution, I guess I should say. Right? So you have what Innes is constantly talking about in his essays, let's say from 1942 even, but certainly by 1944, he's constantly talking about what happens with newspapers and with other types of rapid communication. It was steamboats and railways and all this stuff. What happens to human beings? How do they become unbalanced through this process?
Did you ever read letters to Playboy that McLuhan did in the late 60s? You ever come across them?
Late 60s or 70s?
No, late 60s. He wrote letters a lot to Playboy.
No.
Okay.
Maybe you could, if you have those, send them to me, please.
Yeah, I'd have to make copies, because when I was in L.A.
Yeah.
in 77, when Carol was doing a two-month elective there, I went to the microfiche of UCLA. They had all the Playboys, and I went through them all and found all the letters. I used to read them, look for them, every issue in the late 60s, so I knew they were there. Then I found a place that had Playboy on microfilm. So there's a guy who writes an article, Alan Harrington. He writes an article on the coming psychopath, or the rise of the psychopath, in 69-70, and McLuhan latches onto that article and says, yes, that's what we're going to see, more and more weird psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the extreme of the autonomy side of mass man. You have maybe the crowd dynamic of hippies or John Birchers, fanatical Republicans or Democrats or Black Lives Matter. That's the beehive part of the tactile, multi-bodied situation. But also the direction for silence and autonomy leads to the psychopath. So you got
mm-hmm.
two. So you have the collective flash mob and then the psychopath. These are happening at the same time.
Correct.
So Alan Harrington, he hit upon it. And when I started attending William Irwin Thompson's lectures at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, 93, 94, up to 99, the woman who was the secretary of the dean there at the church, Peggy Harrington, she was the widow of Alan Harrington. He died back then. And so one day we just got talking, and she brought up, and I said, oh, I know that article and what he did, and well, here's what McLuhan said about it. So I actually met the someone connected to that article, which I always remembered it. It was an important letter. You know, here's McLuhan. They're thinking he's a guy saying, oh, wonderful pastoral utopia is coming. You know, silly stuff. That I call it the Madison Avenue McLuhan. And here he is looking at hard facts about this rise of a psychopath.
Sure,
and
sure.
The serial killer and all that.
Yeah, so he not only saw the dangers of the new environment, he saw the dangers of losing the old one.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was also talking about loss of private identity, loss of stability, loss of democracy, loss of privacy, all of these things that had their roots in the Gutenbergian galaxy.
Yeah.
He wanted to preserve, but you could only preserve them by understanding media plural.
Yeah, so and you know, you have Freud, Jung, every different theory of our ills and how to counter it, and I would say McLuhan's was the most balanced and the most useful of diagnosing the problems and what to do about them. You know,
mm-hmm.
Everybody was
yeah.
becoming a therapist in different ways in an information society from the 60s on. Edgar Friedenberg used to talk about that in his class at Dalhousie. He would sit in on... he did The Vanishing Adolescent in the Gutenberg Galaxy. But the overall, McLuhan's therapy was the best, the most comprehensive.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah, and the most up-to-date about our issues.
Yeah, it wasn't the most accurate sort of theoretically. Right. If you read a couple pages of Heidegger and then you read a couple pages of McLuhan, you come away just sort of shaking your head about McLuhan.
Right.
But if you think about it, if you don't just react to it but think about it, then and understand the complexities of what McLuhan is implicating.
Yeah.
Then it's very impressive.
Yeah, and more relevant. So he. When he says, I don't deal with concepts, I deal with percepts, that would be him looking at the mood of the last 18 months. I'm just quoting Zappa. He said, there's always a new fad every 18 months, he said, in the late 60s. So that sense of a fad or a new mood, McLuhan's very aware of, and that was the percept that he was encountering, not concepts. He was engaging in an ESP. He felt he was in tune to what... made people get obsessive about for a couple of months or years, and he could look at the empirical reasons for it by the characteristics of the environment around him. So it was very precise what he's doing, but in communicating it, it can't be a conceptual etymology like Heidegger did. You know, he was writing about the weather, and the weather was not in your normal weatherman terms anymore.
Right. No, that's I like that way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean that's what I was always interested in the zeitgeist or something, and that's probably what appealed to me about McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
That he was encountering what was being generated in what he called the collective consciousness.
Right.
We were unconscious of how we became collectively conscious, but we were collectively conscious. Right? Here comes everybody. Everybody was dealing with the same phenomenon all the time through the American media domination. Everybody had to deal with the Beatles. Everybody had to deal with what? Nixon in 1968. and all that happened in 68 and all the assassinations. I don't think that was McLuhan's point. In the 30s and 20s, you'd read about it. You wouldn't get all aggravated like people did once you get into the global theater.
Mm-hmm.
Ever became, I guess you'd call, PAC journalism.
Yeah. So this actually is another point that Innes constantly makes about newspapers in the 19th century, that they discovered the way to get viewers was to hep them up. Newspapers for the first half of the 19th century were very staid. They were controlled by government. In order to publish a newspaper, you had to buy stamps, and it was an expensive process. Mm-hmm. You weren't allowed to report what was going on in Parliament, for example. And so then newspapers were able to extricate themselves from this straitjacket, and they began to hep up the audience. And that's, according to Innes, this hepping up process was one of the ways that society became unbalanced.
Right. Now, was that because of the telegraph? Is that what Innes says?
No, Innes is not. This whole idea that McLuhan and Innes are technological determinists is bullshit. For Innes, of course, the rise of newspapers is related to technological developments. If you didn't have good roads, if you didn't have good access to paper, if you didn't have a way of printing that wasn't too expensive, then of course you couldn't have newspapers in a modern sense. So of course there's a relationship between developments in the environment, technological developments in the environment, and the possibility of having newspapers hep up the population. But it's not the case that this is only a technological thing. It's also a thing that is going on in both individuals and in society psychologically. And it would be unbalanced to come down on one side or the other. You have to see how technology and insight work together, or work sometimes positively together, sometimes negatively together, but they work together, and that working then produces effects that are generative of the future.
Right. So what is technology determinism?
Well, who knows? It's if you think about it a lot, it's incoherent, right? People throw around the phrase, but they haven't really thought of it.
Right, and you're saying that tends toward the sociological, and they miss the psychological.
Yeah, when people say that Innes and McLuhan are technological determinists, that simply is a misreading. It's an imposition on their texts.
But they do emphasize technology in a way that hadn't been done before. So how is it slightly technological determinist?
Well, I don't know if there is such a thing as slightly technological determinist.
Well, technology
what
is...
What they show is that the human mind is decisively shaped by technology, but at the exact same time, technology is shaped by the human mind. And so you have a very complicated figure.
Oh, so that's
and one
tactile.
Of their,
yeah, so the...
One of their...
The technological determinist tends to be too Gutenberg and robotic.
Correct.
You're missing the interplay. Okay.
Correct.
What will we call that? Tactile determinist?
Well, you never get away from the tactile.
Yeah.
You simply have a tactility that is downplayed, but it's still tactility.
Yeah.
So in a certain way, the beehive community that we were just talking about, you could say that this is tactility squared.
Yeah.
And the extreme emphasis on an individual might be tactility to the minus one or something.
Maybe so horizontal. Yeah, beehive is horizontal, and tactility for the individual is vertical.
Yes, yeah.
That's an interesting update.
Yeah.
I think we've stumbled into another insight.
Well, maybe. I wonder if we ever got back to archive.
Okay, so technology incarnate. Tech body is information. Archive is information. The idea that archive came from visual space may be true, but then the newer media made new kinds of archives. So that's another example of people being different before Gutenberg from after. Because once you had media superseding the Gutenberg, that's devastating. That is mutating. And McLuhan even said, when radio came in, we evolved a million years. Did you ever see that sentence?
Yes.
That's a really important sentence. We changed, we leaped a million years in cliche evolution terms.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes he says 10,000 years in a week or something.
Yeah.
That was an image he liked to use. The whole idea there is that time is not some kind of constant.
Right.
The idea of the constancy of time was a Gutenbergian.
So you could take, the Hugo quote, they think, we're a certain way before Gutenberg and then a different way after. But nobody developed the imagination that the changes of the people after, they were changed many times through millions years. That you have to get to McLuhan to get to that updating of Hugo.
Well, but it's implied in Innes. When Innes takes the singular revolution of Gutenberg and then says, that then there was another revolution of the newspaper and another of the radio. What he's saying is that faster and faster humans are getting erased.
Yeah. And I have no problem with the term technological determinist in the sense of the tactile meaning. We are determined by technology to the degree we're not aware of what's going on. We are determined. That's the updating of Krishnamurti and the conditioned response that McLuhan brought in. And maybe Innes began it. But McLuhan, the guru figure, was more, resonant in the 60s because the individual becomes ideogrammic, translucent, an icon, under satellite conditions. You have the celebrity culture, maybe is the phrase they say, comes in. And so McLuhan comes across as a guru because that's the zeitgeist. That's what happens to anybody who gets attention for a while.
Yeah, well, he put on that persona. Not entirely comfortably, but he did it.
Right, and he included it. That would be what he and Thiel studied in the early 50s when they studied the occult, and Edgar Cayce and these people. He was looking at the charismatic individual, probably with the patina of coming from Asia and the East.
Mm-hmm.
Why would the... Go ahead.
What was going on at that period of time? And by the way, let me mention that... We've already gone over our appointed time, and
we got to.
I'll have to.
We'll end in a minute.
I'll have to break off soon, but it's a very interesting topic. What was going on with McLuhan in the early 1950s, when he was he had always been aware of the question of balance and the question of how extremes can take away from it. But what he became conscious of in the early 1950s was the idea that people were intentionally trying to unbalance society.
Yeah.
And that was something that he says himself. He had never been aware of that. He had been sort of naive in thinking that problems were personal, individual. But they were problems of sin. They were problems of greed. And what he came to see is that a lot of these things were collective. And he hadn't seen that before. And he hadn't seen that there were bodies that were consciously, financially, bringing about these collective, how can I say,
mania.
Yeah, manias that were intentionally militaristic and intentionally introducing instabilities to the world, and that shocked McLuhan.
Where does he say that he was shocked? Where do you get evidence of that?
Oh, there's lots of evidence of that in the his writings in the 1950s. He began to look at art, since Coleridge, for example, as artists taking on themselves extreme operations that were unimaginably hurtful, right? If you look at the very end of the Coleridge essay, for example, and then realize that McLuhan is talking about himself, you realize that what he had been going through in the 1950s was a very painful exercise. I have a couple of posts where I quote stuff about this. I can send you links if you want.
Yeah, send those. I'd like to look
okay.
at that.
Okay, no
well, let's end on that fine point, or fine breakthrough, or a new door. So, all right, thanks a lot, and we'll continue in 2 weeks.
And if you can find any of those.
Yeah, the Playboy letters.
Yeah.
I'll have to
start
gathering.
If you can send me those, that'd be great.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Cameron.
Talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Yep. Okay, bye.
Ciao.